Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everybody, and welcome back to the Tone Arries podcast. I am your host, James, and I'm joined by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Ron is on the deck. Say hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
And Joanne O'Dwyer from Drogheda is in the audience, or is at the table with us. How are you, Joanne?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here today.
Thanks for coming down. Thanks for coming down. How's your stay in Cork?
Yeah, lovely. Great time. Well, lovely food last night. People are lovely. Had a lovely swim, massage, sauna. And I'm here now feeling amazing.
And you brought the lovely weather with you.
I know. Well, it did rain on the way down the road, but great.
We've been in contact for a few months, and you're a fan of the podcast.
I am.
And you've got your own story.
Yeah.
A brilliant story, which we're going to get into.
An inspirational story. Yeah.
And as I said before we started, we don't have enough women in recovery because of, but what we'll get into, this shame and the stigmas of addiction is worse for a woman. And I think that's why they don't be so forthcoming compared to the men. So, but before we get into that, we go way back for the people that don't know you. Who's Joanne and where you're from?
Joanne, well, I was originally born in a little village in Sligo. So my passport says Sligo. I was there for around 4 years. My mum was a housewife. Before that, she was a priest housekeeper. My dad was a chef. So I said this to you on the phone, I don't know the difference between middle class and working class, but I think we were pretty normal, you know. My dad now was from inner city Dublin, tenement flats, had moved out and then kind of was, you know, had left Dublin when he was in his teenage years and became a chef and had worked his way up. So fairly normal. I was the second child. I had an older brother, and then I came very quickly, and then I had another sister and brother. And when around the age of 4 or 5, we moved from Sligo, and we moved to Cavan. And that was kind of, I suppose, typified, if that's the right word, how my kind of, we moved a lot as children. And for me, when I look back now, I suppose is one of the reasons that maybe I was such an anxious, kind of nervy child, constantly reinventing yourself when you went somewhere new. And I was pretty overweight as a child, as I said to you, I talked about to you about the food issues. But constantly moving from place to place. So I would have moved from there to Offaly, Galway, Carlow, ended up in Dublin, and then ended up where I am now. But in that, I went to London and different places. So constantly moving, new schools, new areas.
Did you see the conversation we had with traveller man Patrick McCann?
No, I didn't.
Well, he spoke about growing up as a child in Manchester. And then
moving
from site to site to site. I suppose you could relate a bit like that, having to reinvent yourself, make new friends, new dynamics.
Yeah, getting used to the new area, the new environment. Knowing what you can and cannot say.
The child needs consistency, don't they?
Yeah. So, and you were prone to bullying as well. That was something I noticed, because you were the new kid.
Mm.
So
you always stood out, like.
Yeah, you were always a new kid. It was a bit overweight. And I suppose my personality, I would have tried to put on a front and tried to be, you know, put on a mask or a face or whoever. But really underneath, I was scared and anxious, and I would have been, you know, full of fear going to school all the time. So, I was a good kid in school, but when I remember when I was around 11 or 12, I had a lot of, I got asthma, And I was only thinking about this last week. This is my first kind of, when I realised that actually I was using drugs before I actually started using drugs. I was in a bad asthmatic, and I was prescribed medication, and my mum and dad would have been working and out working. I was left at home from school to take your own medication. And sure, I realised one day I took a few too many, and I was getting a little, oh, this is nice. This is a nice little kick. And I remember very quickly, in a few days after I was doing it, and then I realised, I'll stay at home maybe and take these. I won't even go, you know what I mean? I was staying at home from school taking this medication. And I remember one day hallucinating, the doctor coming into the house and me like running down the corridor screaming that there was someone attacking me. It was only the doctor coming to see me, but I was off my head. And I think of that now, you know, when I know now about, you know, medication and stuff. But that was, I suppose, the first, and that stage we were living in Carlow. School was, I was a good kid, but I remember in second year in school, I won like a class prize. So I was, and you know, I always wanted to please. I was very much a people pleasing child. I was very good at home. I would have worked, mum and dad would have had like, I suppose they were in the hospitality industry, catering and stuff. And dad was, you know, would you had in the kitchen working with him, and there would have been, you know, he had bars and stuff. And, I was always a good worker, and I always wanted to, you know what I mean, to please my mum and dad. But in second, third year in school, I remember going from winning class prize, I suppose, to doing a very, very poor junior cert. And I would have started drinking at that stage. Would have started, you know, messing around.
They enjoy years, aren't they? The 14s and the 15s, aren't they?
Yeah, and we had easy access to alcohol. It was only like it was very normal. Alcohol was very normalised in our house. There was addiction in the house, so. You know, to drink at 14, 15, where, you know, we would have been given drink at that age, you know what I mean, from you know, in the family. So, yeah, I remember going to school, definitely in my junior cert years, being hungover and drink, you know, Friday, Monday morning, that type of stuff.
But you know, when you say your family were in catering, is that where you were moving? Was it work-related?
Mum and dad, I know, like, there was huge love in the house, but I suppose unknown to them, moving constantly had its impact on me. If you look at my other three siblings, I suppose, you know, and I'll talk about that later, I suppose, you know, my addiction was very evident, but when I look at some of them, maybe, you know, their addiction is work, or is, you know, they've different type of coping skills for you know, the life that they had. But yeah, that's why we moved a lot, because of the business and stuff. And it was out of a good place. Like, it was out of, you know, my mum and dad wanted to do well. But I remember dad had investment in a hotel in Carlow, and he lost everything. You know, it went into liquidation, and he really, really struggled with that. And he would have, I suppose, leaned a lot harder on alcohol to manage that, and he lost everything around that time, you know. So, in our later years in school, we ended up, my brother and myself ended up having to live in another house away from the family system. And I suppose my drinking would have got a lot heavier at that stage, and drug use. I started smoking weed and stuff in like the last 2 years in school. And
where are you living at this stage?
Carlow. And my mum and dad are living in Laois, but we're living in Carlow.
Woohoo.
It's a mad situation. With a family that kind of... We lived with them midweek, and we went home at the weekends, and we worked in the family business, and I went back. So we had a lot of freedom, myself and my brother, an awful lot of freedom. And that's where I just decided, well, sure, I could drink and I could do whatever I wanted. Yeah, so that was up until I'd done a pretty poor leaving cert for someone who's probably pretty very capable. Yeah. I'd done I remember I wanted to leave the year before. I was going to become a chef like my dad, and they convinced me to stay on. But leaving cert year, I wasn't with it at all. I was just scraped by, and there was incidents in school where I was getting in trouble, and I was just acting out. And I'd went from a very people pleasing young girl to wanting to not giving two fecks with anybody, really, you know. And
what kind of drugs were you using at that point?
cannabis, alcohol. I hadn't moved on to anything hard at that stage. When I got into college, then I got into Carlow IT, and I always say this, I sought out people who are doing drugs. Mm. And if I remember, I can actually, I consciously sought out people that were using drugs. I suppose I didn't touch on something there. There was, would have been, I suppose what I know now, I suppose as adverse childhood experiences as I'd grown up, there was trauma from a young age, you know what I mean? And I would have really struggled with that. And I remember getting to around 14, 15 going, I'm going to do every drug there is out there. I'm going to fucking, I just want to, you know what I mean?
Get rid of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to completely escape this.
I want, yeah. And I knew that, you know, cannabis was giving me a bit of a kick and alcohol, but it was like, there has to be something more. There's something more out there that
there's
I have.
Something will give that to me what I need.
Yeah. I knew I was on the right track.
And it does come.
Yeah. It did.
And when it happens, then it's like, oh, Jesus, where's
the ecstasy?
Where were you all the time?
it was the ecstasy at a young age.
And
yeah, that was the when I went to college. Very quickly found a group of smoking weed, ecstasy, acid, mushrooms. This was these were just fucking. I loved them. I loved the love. I loved the feeling it gave me, the warmth. And I've heard you talk about this as well. But just that whole everybody, you know, and the immense love you have for people, and the crack, and the night, the whole, and wanting to stay up, and wanting it to last forever, and not want to go to bed, and dreading seeing the sunlight because you had to, another day you had to come.
Go looking for more then.
Yeah.
Oh, stop.
Knocking a fella's door at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and they come knock the door, and they're looking at you, and, what do you want at my door? Like, and you're looking up at him,
he's
swinging
off. Yeah.
What's wrong with
you? I know.
Just come on.
Just give it to me, by with that.
Just come on, come down.
You know.
But at some stage,
the party ends, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a nice feeling then.
No, it's not. But I suppose you really have to go. At them early ages, you know, you can enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, you're still a free spirit.
But you've no, there's no consequences, really. No responsibility.
No.
Your sole purpose in life is to just get out of your head.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe a day might go where you've no money, but definitely not 2 days.
No, but it, as you said then, like, it just keeps climbing. You said it earlier on, like, it was just something there to soothe the way you were feeling internally, you know?
Yeah, and it was. So definitely, when I look at it now.
Did you go from secondary school into college?
I did, yeah. Like, I mean, like, a course of, like, 200 points I got, you know, where it was, like, I possibly was capable of getting a course that was, like, before, like, 400 points. I was pretty okay, but I just lost all interest. This was what I wanted. This was, why would I bother studying? Why would I, when I could be drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
All of us at this table are proof that ability doesn't mean anything if you're not in the right headspace. Because it's not that I couldn't tell you how many points I got. Honestly, like, about 10, I'd say.
Yeah. The only points I ever got were the ones they kicked over the bar.
Or penalty points.
The only point. Plenty of penalty points as well.
But it's not that there was a lack of ability of intelligence. It was just because we weren't in the right headspace. We weren't in the right frame of mind. And like, it goes back to like the hierarchy of needs. You know what I mean? If you're not well in yourself and, you know, you're insecure and your basic needs are... How can you focus on education you know, future? Do you know what I mean?
Something else is here, like, and it needs to be attended to first.
Exactly. Yeah.
And do you know what else drugs done for me? And I was talking about this. They helped me lose weight. I was seriously, you know what I mean?
He's so good at that, aren't they?
Brilliant.
The weight fell off me. I went to London for... I
had a six-pack. I was at it for 6 months. 6 months every night of the week.
The only six-pack I had was six cans of Linden Village.
But the best drugs, like, the you know what I mean? The weight fell off me. I remember I went, I'll go on and tell you. I dropped out that year in college. By the Christmas, I had dropped out, but I didn't tell my parents. And I just stayed partying for the year. And one night, my mother... towards the end of the year, my mother, there was a knock on the door where I was staying, and my mother was looking for me, but she had got word, or someone had told her, a guard that knew her, said the house was going to be raided that I was living in, because we were doing a little bit of dealing to your mates, you know, keeping the mouth supplied,
tipping away.
Yeah. And my mother's brother was a guard, and someone had told him, said, you know, obviously the word got through to him that it was a house that I was living in, and got pulled out of that, and she realised then I wasn't going to college, I wasn't there at all. So that summer I went to London, and then, yeah, that was just a whole nother...
Different level of stuff.
Going to, like, Club UK, Raven, you know, Wednesday, Thursday,
Friday. When was that, back in the 90s?
1995. 5.
That was a mad time.
Yes.
The height. That was a mad time. Yeah. Wasn't it? Scene, remember, even back here in Cork at that time, it was completely mad. Like
Carl Cox, fucking. It was just, it was a great time. And it was. I loved it. It was great. But I was probably there for a year and a half, and I was selling speed, and I was selling yokes, and I was just tipping around, being taught I was the great one, you know, the gangster. Like, it was a great time. When I think of it now, I made great friends, but all of them, when I look at it now, I don't think there's too many of them that ended up where they all went back to their, you know, back to their lives. Is where I was like, no, I want more of this. This is great, crack. So,
it goes back to the trauma thing that you spoke about, you know. Lots of people will experiment drugs at some stage of their life, but if you have all that underlying stuff, you're far more likely to use that and go into addiction than somebody that doesn't. They might be able to go through that phase and then go on about their lives and never end up in addiction.
It's like you said it there, you know, when you were using drugs, had you much self-esteem?
No, it was no confidence.
But when you were stoned, you had plenty of it.
Yeah.
You know, and you were getting used to having the self-esteem, the confidence, the bit of respect you were getting for selling the drugs. And
you don't want to live without it.
How would you want
then
to lose that identity? Because you're getting noticed in life. You're getting respect. You're getting noticed by people as somebody. Fuck it, look, who it is.
Trying is good for getting, you know, the drugs or shops.
I was a great mate, crack. I was the best of crack. I was, you know, so people want to be around you. And when you weren't doing that, people didn't want to be around you. And when you're coming from a place of that, like you said, from trauma and from being overweight, low self-esteem, low self-worth, being anxious, that's, you know what I mean? It's such a fake place, but it's the place you want to be, because it's serving you so well.
It's a coping skill, isn't it? And it works.
Yeah.
Until it didn't.
Yeah. Was there at any point during these periods like that you were suffering with your mental health in a bad way that, like, it was really, really bad
later, like, on when it went to, yeah, well, I suppose we've all had downers where we're coming off stuff and we're like, oh, it's dreadful, but, you know, we know now that that's only a bad day. But yeah, when I moved on to, I suppose, to heroin and coke, there would have been, and I even there a few weeks ago, I found a suicide note that I obviously kept it for a reason, but I remember looking at it and I was saying goodbye to people, and one part of me is going, oh, you fucking idiot, cringing, and then the other part of me is going, you must have been in a bad fucking place to wrote that, you know. And there was, yeah, later on, yes, there was my mental health, like, I would have been, you know, some self-harm and, you know what I mean, cutting myself, not to the level, I suppose, that I want to work with people now that I see, but definitely, some bit of, like, purging and making myself sick after binge eating would have happened as well. But yeah, there was definitely times of, like, when the heroin addiction got to the very end, yeah, there was very dark times, and times where I probably thought I was better off and leaving my son and leaving, because I was just such a mess at that stage, you know.
What age was your son born?
He was born in 2000. I was, I ended up, when I came back from London, I met his dad, and we started, I suppose I was still going out, going to the Ormond, going to sides, going partying, raves, and there was nights then where I realised that there was people smoking heroin to come down off yokes. And I remember going, I'm never doing that. That's there for junkies.
You move back to Dublin?
Yeah, we came home from London. And when I moved home from London, my parents were living in Dublin. So I found myself a nice flat in Ballybock in the city centre. And I remember at the time there was a lot of vigilante marches going on. I remember there was
concerned regularly parents against drugs.
Yeah. And myself and my son's dad, and God, he's dead since, so I won't. But he we got together, and sure, he was a drug dealer, and we were, you know, it was living a good life at the beginning. But there was nights where there was people smoking heroin, and I was like, I'm never doing that. But sure, there was a day where I needed to go to work, or I needed to, you know what I mean, to function the following day, and someone said, take that, you'll sleep, and that was it. Then I remember, that's when I knew I found what I was looking for, because I remember smoking it going, what the fuck is this?
It's such a nice feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like someone got me and wrapped their arms around me and gave me the biggest kiss and hug I'd ever got. I felt so secure, and so, because
all of a sudden life becomes manageable.
Yeah, because all my life I hadn't had that, nobody had ever, and I was just, this is it. Yeah, and that was it. Nights on yokes ceased to exist then. And it was, and I remember we all, our mates that we used to go out, we'd used to come and knock on the door, and we'd be hiding in, and he, Mark used to live at a little shed out the back of his mother's, and we'd hide, we had the curtains pulled, and we'd be smoking away, and we'd hide, and they'd be, are you coming out? And we'd be, no, we're not going out tonight, we're not. 4 or 5 bags under, you know what I mean? And we'd spend the whole, so all weekends then ended up from going from partying and doing yokes to sitting in and smoking and smoking. And
I said the story a few times, but back in before heroin came into Cork, you know, we used to be drinking up in Hollyville, and every Thursday some of the lads that used to be working used to join us, you know, Thirsty Thursday, bag of cans, you know, good crack, and then the heroin started coming in, and at the end of the cans we go and we get some gear and we'd smoke that, and slowly but surely the tinfoil took over the drug, the alcohol, and Thirsty Thursday turned into Tinfoil Thursday, and Tinfoil Thursday turned into Tinfoil Wednesday morning, and Tinfoil Monday, and then there was no work, and then it was just all Tinfoil, and it's just, the crack goes with it, doesn't it? Any bit of socialising is gone.
Yeah, he didn't want anybody. He didn't want anybody we used to hang out with, we smoked weed with, or we'd done anything with. I mean, just pulled away from them, because they, you know, would have been the judgment on it, I suppose.
And yeah, and there's a bit of shame around
it. Oh, there is, yeah.
And was heroin at that point in Dublin was everywhere, yeah, as well, wasn't
it? Yeah, you're talking 97, 1996, 97, 98, around them years, yeah. It wasn't long then before. Like, I remember being sick the first time. I remember being sick and saying to me that I wasn't going to go and meet him because I didn't feel well. And he was like, what do you mean you don't feel well? And I said, just feel like, I don't feel good. And I'm not, you know what I mean? And he's going, you're sick. You're sick. And I said, what do you mean I'm sick? And he's like, you're sick. You're sick because you don't have heroin. And I'm going, what? Okay, you're right. And then there was times we tried to get off it, and we would be like, I remember he bought me methadone once, street methadone. I remember taking it, being violently sick, like 30 mils, being violently sick. And things went on like that. We started then dealing, and eventually moved on to the needle. There was a night where didn't have it, there wasn't enough to go around, the two of us, and we just, something I never thought I'd ever do.
I know.
You know what I mean? All
them thoughts, though, they become reality eventually, don't they?
They do, yeah.
You know, I never used heroin myself because I had first-hand experience with people that were using heroin back in early in the 90s when I lived in France, and I got a really bad fright, you know. And I remember being at home, inside my family home. I'd come in the door, James would hang around with my younger brothers, and I'd walk in the door and two of them would be inside in the front room and their fucking heads would be like that, dropping. But I was so naive, I didn't want to believe that there was anything else. They'd tell me that they're after taking a few joints, you know, and that was it. And I believed it. I remember the first time someone
turned around. It's easier to believe than accept the reality of it, like.
The first time someone turned around to me and they says, you know what, Timmy, your two brothers are strung out in gear, like. And I said, fuck off, you fool. And you ended up fighting, you know. I says, nah, they're not that stupid at all. They wouldn't go near that. And they did. The two of them got strung out. You know, for me, as far as I ever went, I liked the crack cocaine, and I really liked it towards the end, and I might go on a binge for a week or something like that. But thankfully, that experience that I had back in France in 96, 97, it stopped me from ever wanting to go down that road, no matter how sick I was coming down off cocaine or tablets or drink or whatever, you know, so I'm very, very grateful for that. You know, if anything, what I get from France was the
healthy fear of it. Like, yeah. I think I had a fear of it too, because my dad is from Dublin and he was well aware of what heroin did to Dublin. But it was sold to us in a way, it was a safe or non-addictive way, smoking it on the tin foil. It was harmless. It's not needles, it's not HIV, it's not, you know. It's not like blood or, you know, all these kind of stereotypes.
Yeah.
And it's nice and it makes you feel nice and, you know. That was it. And until one day you can't get it. And then you're sick. And it's like, sick. I didn't think that I'd get these type of withdrawals if I wasn't. It's just stupid naivety, really. Do you know what I mean?
What kind of sickness is it? What does it feel like? Is it like you describe it like anything else?
Do you know, like if you had a bad flu?
Yeah.
A very bad flu.
It's a very it's a very bad flu. And then you throw in on top of it insomnia, probably diarrhea.
Okay. And how long does that that last
about 5 days.
Yeah, legs, restless legs. I remember that's the one thing. I remember doing a detox and coming out of Beaumont and off. I did detox me off methadone. I remember the legs. I just couldn't. My legs would not stop shaking. I couldn't sleep.
No, we used to get me the most.
Just this feeling of your legs just jumping.
Oh. The coldness. Your body would be, you know, every little hair follicle on your body would be standing up from head to toe. All over your skin is crawling.
And the nose running and comfy.
But you know what you get great relief from? Just lying in a hot bath or standing under a hot shower. And you used to get great relief for that. And if I was going cold turkey, I'd have 4 or 5 baths in the day if I was locking myself into a house, you know what I mean? But it's fucking horrible, isn't it?
Oh, stop. Oh, and I mean, rubbing Vicks on my legs. I used to be rubbing Vicks on my legs to try and stop them from the shaking and the just anything to...
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that. And my back used to kill me. I never forget that. The pain in my back.
And you know what how intense all that is? Do you know if you just take one drag of the smoke?
Gone.
One.
Yeah.
Gone.
But even you have in your hand and it's gone.
Oh, really?
Do you know the psychological part of, like, you meet it, you're dying sick. The minute you have in your hand and it's like, I'm okay. Because it is. I mean, you know you have it then. And it's like...
Yeah.
I'm going to be okay in a bit. But my vein, like, even today, I was getting bloods done. I've no veins now, right? They're all, right, because towards the end I was using coke and gear together, so my veins are booked. And even the end, like, I struggled to get my veins, and I used to be skin popping, and I'd be, you know, syringes full of blood, and you'd be getting ulcers, and, you know, like, just in a mess. But even still, anything into you, just to... If I get so panicky that I wouldn't be able to get my vein, I'd just stick it in me anywhere just so that you'd get some relief, because you're not going to waste a bag. You're not going to waste, you know.
And that is the reality of it, isn't it, Joanne? Like, that is the reality of yeah, that life.
Desperation.
Yeah.
It was crazy at the end. Absolutely.
You know. What was it? How bad did it get for you before? How did it come to a head? What was the turning point for you?
My son was 4. I had him. I remember walking out of the hospital with him, and like I was Hep C positive. I was, and like Mark, most of the two of us were chronic, like absolutely. And I thought when I had my son that would be the motivation to get clean, but it wasn't, because he actually got way worse then. And myself and his dad kind of went our separate ways. And I suppose I started. I was carrying drugs for people. I was doing a bit of, and we had done a lot of dealing. We used to go in and out of, like, bring drugs into the country, myself and Mark. But when King came along, that wasn't. So I was kind of running around for people and doing, you know, carrying stuff in cars and that type of stuff. Things got, yeah, pretty, I suppose. Like, I started using coke and gear together. And that was a whole nother.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Another level of, you know what I mean? I was
like, just so people understand this, right? That is to the extent you have to go to get drugs to feed your habit. Like,
yeah, because the gear wasn't doing it anymore for me. So I had to mix it with coke then.
In order to... You have to feed it in some way, and you go to absolutely any lengths to get what you need.
What's it like injecting cocaine and heroin at one time?
You get a huge rush from the coke. You get the coke first, a huge, and then you don't have that horrible fucking feeling from coke. It's kind of a more mellow. And I'm not glorifying.
I know.
Yeah, it's nice.
It's stronger.
I'm not. I don't want to glorify it. But yeah, it is. You get the coke. You get the hit from the coke first, and then you get the gear kind of, and it takes the edge off. You know, when you come down off coke, and it's like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just inject coke on its own, and then I take the gear afterwards. I feel the effects of it, and then. The gear afterwards come down.
There's a lot of people injecting cocaine these days. It's something like I really, really never heard of it.
You know, it used to be a big thing. Do you remember the snowblower from the head shops?
Yeah.
Injecting that with heroin was a big thing.
Really?
But
ruined the coke, ruined your veins.
Does it?
Really? Is it because of the chemicals that are in it?
Eats away at your veins and just ruins your veins.
So how did it all end for you?
Sorry, you asked me already. I was on a charge for an armed robbery. I had a good few charges at this stage for different stupid things. And I remember I was in court just around this time of year. And I was injecting into my neck and into my groin. And my doctor had been saying, like, you're going to end up dead if you don't cop yourself on. And I was in court for the armed robbery. And I remember I wasn't in a good place, and the judge started shouting at me that I was presented in court off my head and disrespecting the court. And I remember seeing the guard coming towards me with the handcuffs, and I was obviously going to prison for this, the armed robbery. And a guard stood up that knew me and said, he knew my dad, and he said he pleaded with the judge not to lock me up, that I was a good person, but that I just went down a bad road and that I had a child. And I remember getting away with it, and I walked outside. I got a suspended sentence, and I had to give, probation for 2 years or 3 years. And I got outside the court, and he came out after me, running after me, and he said, "You need to cop yourself on, or you're going to end up dead or in prison." And he said, you're like what we talked about earlier, you're so capable and you've got so much going for you. He said, but you're going to end up in, you know what I mean, something bad's going to happen to you. That was within that and a conversation with my doctor at the time. And my mum and dad had left Dublin and had moved again to where I am now. And they said, why don't you come down and see what what you think of County Loud, and you know, if you don't like it, you move back to Dublin. And at the time I was living in squalor with Keane, and I'd moved out of the home. Me and Keane were living together, and things gonna have to improve. And then I met a man around that time as well, who I married, and I'm since divorced from him, but he supported me, and I'd always give him that. He helped me stop using heroin, and I stopped using heroin the day I met him. I remember I didn't inject anymore after that. That was kind of the turning point for me. At this stage, I was 10 years of madness. And my son, like I said to you earlier, my son used to say to me, like, to take your green medicine, you know, if I wasn't good in myself. And so there was a lot of realisation. I remember looking at him and saying, in another few years, he's not stupid. Like, he's smart, 4 or 5
kid.
Now. Yeah.
Smart kid. Yeah.
He's not, you know, I'm not going to get much longer out of this. So that was in 2005. That's the last time I injected heroin. But as I said to you earlier, I thought I was, I've stopped injecting heroin and everything's grand and I'll just move on with my life. But that was only the start of it. I was on probably 78 mils of methadone, a lot of benzos, street benzos, and probably prescribed. And the whole process of that, I ballooned to 24, 25 stone. I just started eating. I mean, I couldn't walk. I was so big. So I thought I was, you know, I had done the piece of work myself, but I hadn't. I hadn't looked at what was going on inside me psychologically. I hadn't started peeling back the shit, the years of crap. So
how did you get on that journey of the personal development?
I've been through my whole, like, I been to different therapists all through addiction, but you know yourself when you're sitting there off your head in front of somebody, there's only that much of it landing with you. So, and I got in touch with a therapist down here and started, and then I started doing a lot of my own self-help stuff. So I started meditating, started a kind of mindfulness, started self-educating myself, started reading up on stuff, and then I decided, right, maybe I'll go back to college. So I applied as a mature student to University of Ulster. I also went through Hep C treatment in 2011 or so. So then 4 or 5 years of just trying to get some stability and kind of build myself back up, and started to do the work on myself around the huge amount of weight loss, the waist gain that I had, and, you know, and what all that was. And it all started to make sense then, why I was, you know, the overeating and the addiction and all that. I'd done the work on myself. I'm not saying I ever do, you never do the whole work on yourself. It's always, I've done enough to get me by.
You get enough to get you where you are today.
I'm enough to get me by at the moment, because I don't want to run off and use a bag of heroin. I don't want to eat, but like...
And you get comfortable, in this spot too, but you have to kind of shock yourself into saying there's a whole lot more there. You're able to deal with your stuff now, even the stuff from years and years ago, because you have tools to understand that there's nothing wrong with you. You're a good person. I deserve to be loved. You know, I'm smart. You know, I can do this. I don't need drugs or alcohol to get me through. But there's more. There's absolutely a whole lot more of peace. There's a whole lot more understanding. There's a whole lot more forgiveness for you. There's so much more. And the reason I'm saying this now is because I have gotten comfortable being able to just get by and not be as bad as things were before. But no, I said, no, do you know what? We'll do a little bit more work because there's more healing there to be done. A whole lot more, you know, a whole lot.
And we'll never get a certificate saying we've recovered. Go on about your business. That won't happen.
It's like, handed here, like, here's your degree, your master's. There's nothing like that.
Yeah, it's ongoing. It's constantly ongoing. For life. Yeah.
For life.
Yeah.
And thank God. Thank God we'll never be perfect. Thank God. Because the day I believe that I'm perfect in any way is the day I'm actually after losing my mind again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. I say to people I work with now, and I think this is so true, people in recovery, the work that they do on themselves, we're so much more, superiority or anything, but you look at the amount of work that people in recovery do on themselves, and there's people out there that never look at themselves, never. So, you know, the healing and the, you know, the healing and the growth that we have and self-awareness that we get from our journey and what we've done is, you know what I mean? I think not everybody gets that.
No,
and I think that's a lot of people are, you know.
James said it there is very important too. You know that self-awareness aspect of recovery, right? An awful lot of that comes from the people that are around you as well, and when they point something out. You know, for me, I get pointed out, stuff gets pointed out to me by my kids, and they're my biggest educators, you know. They might say, Dad, you know what? Bring it back a little, you know. You know, you're a little bit heavy in the words, or like, you're kind of, you know, stressed or anxious because I might kind of be more reactive to something. And I've noticed lately there that they're actually right. And instead of me reacting to that and saying, there's nothing wrong with me. No, I said, you know what, you're actually right. You're right. And I am stressed. I am a little bit too busy. So I'm going to pull it back. I'm going to listen. You know, I'm going to give you more time. You know, and that for me is self-reflection as well, through somebody else's eyes. Because if I had to listen to myself and reflect on what my mind is telling me, it's just telling me, you're grand, you're wrong. But it's I'm wrong. Because my ego is the one telling me I'm okay when I'm not okay. You know, and
there's a big part of recovery, I think, is the humility, the idea that, like, we're not recovered, and we do have to continuously, you know, have a look at what we're doing, our behaviours, and be open to learning, and be open to receiving criticism and feedback when it's given to you in the constructive way. The day, as you said it there, the day you think you know it all is the day you stop learning.
Do you know what I mean? And we have to be the learning all the time, no matter how long you are away from a drink or a drug, or even if you're still taking a drink or a drug. Do you know when we spoke off camera, like, recovery is not the day you become abstinent, it's the day you start your recovery. It's the day you decide you want a better life. It's the day you're in recovery, and it's along a continuum. And we know people abstinent for years, and I know people on methadone, and the people on methadone have a way better recovery than the people that are abstinent. So,
yeah, and we all know people in you know, whether in fellowships or whatever, that are as sick as small hospitals. They're not. They might be abstinent, but they haven't done the other piece. Like your drug status is one little part of your recovery piece. It's about everything else that you put around you. It's all your recovery capital. It's you know, it's an attitude to life. It's a being. It's an awareness. It's everything else. But you know, some people just think, oh, I just have to stop using, and then I live the NAA. And I'm not poo pooing NAA. I think it definitely has a place, because I used it in early recovery, but I do think, you know, a lot of people get very fixated on whether it's, you know, your status, or whether you're abstinent or not, and that's, we talked about it, I'm doing my dissertation on that now for my master's, but I do think we need to start looking at recovery as it is just the desire to change.
We had Joanna Ivers on. Do you know Joanna Ivers?
She's my professor, and she's my supervisor for my dissertation, yeah.
Dr. Yeah. Joanna Ivers, doctor. I should address
professor
her.
Professor.
Joanna Ivers. Professor.
Is professor higher than doctor?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
She's professor now.
We got an anonymous letter after that podcast from a staunch AA person that said that we dilute the message of recovery by talking about this stuff. But it's not, we're not giving flack to AA or NA or anything like that. Yeah. We're just like, we have to include everybody in the recovery journey, not just the people that are abstinent, because abstinence is not a mark of your recovery. It can be certainly a good thing to have if that's what you want.
Yeah.
But like, just because you're on medication or methadone or whatever, like, we're still in recovery. You know what I mean? And you have to look at recovery along a continuum, from the day you decide you want a better life to the day you die, and everybody is involved.
And AA and NA and all these different groups, they're absolutely, massively important in anybody's
Everybody
recovery.
Could do with doing the 12 steps.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Massively, yeah, like, because
they're a great way to live your life.
They give you a sense of community at the beginning. They give you a sense of relation.
Fellowship, social circles.
But it's a direction that a lot of people need in early recovery. Because when you were looking for recovery, you know yourself, what do I do? How do I get it? It's just like, nobody gives you a manual for this. So NAA are fantastic for that. It definitely shows people the way. But I do think there's more, 100 ways to skin a cat. Like, and I think one thing that really stuck out for me, and in my research, was that we talk about stigma in addiction and recovery, right? Now, we always talk, you know what I mean, a huge stigma, and people are, you know, it's barriers to getting treatment, and people, you know, don't want to talk about their you know, their situation because of the judgment and all that. But yet, we're now judging people within recovery that are maybe on, you know, medically assisted, or that are, you know, take a drink, or that, because they're not abstinent. So if I went into an AA meeting or an NA meeting today, they'd tell me, no, you take a drink now, so you're not in recovery. So that's a message that we're sending to people, that if you are, you know, if I'm on low dose of methadone, I can't go to a meeting because I'm going to be shunned, I'm going to be stigmatized. So we're ousting a huge population of people in recovery because of their, you know, we're looking at their drug status or alcohol status, is where recovery is, you know, is huge. It's not just about that. That's one part of it.
And it has to be inclusive for everybody.
Yeah. So why, you know, we're the very people that are talking about stigmatizing people, and we feel stigmatized all our lives for being an addiction. But yeah, we're now stigmatizing people in recovery.
You spoke about research you're doing. Do you want to bring us to the education journey? Because education has been a big part of your recovery.
Yes, it has,
so, what was the pathway?
I applied as a mature student to become a counselor psychotherapist in the University of Ulster, and I got accepted. And that was a huge piece of, I suppose, self help. What I started learning on that, it was every day I was going, oh God, that was me. This is very exciting. I remember I used to come home, and I'd be like, on the way, I'm going, the dots were starting to join.
That was me in college as well.
Things start making sense. Coming home and telling people and going, you never guess what they talked about today. And she was talking about attachment. Now, when I look at my, and they'd be like, what is she on about? But it all started to make sense. Stuff started to land with me. And that was a huge piece. I suppose my own learning. I got a CE place in Louth Community Drug and Alcohol, which is now the Red Door, which I'm back in now. I went full circle back to it. They gave me a chance, and I started off there as support staff, and then I got an internship. I had 156 people in Stanhope Centre in Dublin. The HSE gave me an internship, and I remember at the time I'm feeling just, you know, like all the imposter syndrome of why am I here? Why do you have to, you know, they're after giving me this place. And I remember being told on the first day I went in, and the manager said to me, do you know 156 people applied for this post and you got it? And she said, you're just your honesty and your, because I was like, I'm in recovery. And she said, your honesty got it. And I went in. That was huge learning for me as well, because I remember going in and I learned a lot about being a child of someone in addiction. So being, you know, being the other side, because I knew what it was like to be the person, but I started to look at it in a different lens then. I saw what it was like from a family member. So I was trying to relate that, well, that's what it was like for my son, that it was like for me in my house growing up with addiction. So there's a lot of learning for that for me as well. I stayed there for around a year and a half, and then I went to Coolmine. So I got my qualification, became a counsellor, and I went to Coolmine then for 2 years, and the great learning there as well. And also another thing Coolmine gave me was I wouldn't have been as open as I am now about my recovery. Definitely in you know, work and stuff. And Coolmine kind of encouraged me to, you know, be open and proud and loud and proud about it. Yeah, and I did start to own it, and that gave me a huge amount of healing and freedom as well. And I would talk more about it, and kind of, and I suppose, you know, exactly what we're doing here today, trying to get rid of stigma and trying to normalise that people do struggle with mental health and struggle with, you know.
Me and Timmy went public with our stories on the telly and on the podcast. There's huge healing in that for us too, and grow. It's like, I don't have to be worried now about will they find out and work. Everybody fucking knows now. There's a bit of relief now. We're not trying to hide it anymore, do you know? And then when you get people contacting us saying, I can relate with you, I can identify with you, a lot of similarities, what did you do? And then they're on their journey, you know what I mean? And then we keep what we have by giving it away, isn't that the saying?
Yeah.
Like, we can't give it away if we're stuck in a room and our head is down and we say nothing. Get on with your life, keep your head down, don't tell anybody. That doesn't help anybody, you know what I mean? This is the new wave of recovery, you know, do you know? Loud and proud and visible.
Yeah.
It's about you're being loud and proud to actually help those who are quiet in the corners, ashamed, full of guilt and fear because of their own recovery process and where they are in their own life. And it's not about thinking we're anything, thinking we're better than the society or better than anybody. It's about, as James said, it's about changing the stigma, changing how people think around addiction, mental health, so others can come forward and talk about what's going on for them and get the help that they need as well. Because we are growing as a society, as a nation, as a population, and we need to roll with the times, you know, and everybody needs to roll with the times as well. Because 20 years ago, addiction wasn't talked about.
No,
alcoholism wasn't talked about.
And what we're doing with the podcast is, because I started out as addiction and recovery podcast, you know, with people coming in here the whole time talking about they're recovering from they've different eating disorders or chronic illness, but we've all the same life experiences. We're all the same people.
Everybody's been hurt. Everybody's in pain. Everybody, and you're going to Mate, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It was drugs and alcohol, and for others it's food or it's self-harm or it's illness or it's relationships or there's bereavement, but we're all recovering. And if we can get people to just think like that, they're an addiction and we're not an addiction, no, we're all the same. We all feel the same pain. We all want the same things, which is a bit of peace of mind, a bit of contentment. And some of us have different coping skills, but we're all healing together now, you know?
Mm.
It's great, isn't it?
It's brilliant. And having these conversations, and you know, people listening going, actually, it's okay to talk about what's going on for me. And I find that in my research. I've so far interviewed 11 people in recovery. And one of my questions is, do you tell people in recovery? And a lot of people are like, no, I don't. And there's still a huge amount of stigma and shame attached to it. So having these conversations is addressing that. So it's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not like you go around and say, hello, my name's James and I'm in recovery. It's like, if people ask you, I wouldn't deny it. But you don't have to go around fucking telling everybody either, you know what I mean?
But I'll tell you another very important thing, and I think this is, is important for everybody to hear. Those of us who do judge people that are recovering from alcohol, drugs or whatever it may be, you'll never know when you will actually want that person in your life to help your son or daughter or brother or wife or husband, you know, because these people in recovery from alcohol and drugs are the people you're going to turn to when your son or daughter is suffering from alcoholism or drug addiction or mental health or whatever. You'll go to that person because if they have first-hand experience and they can help you. And that's the way I see it. We need to help people in recovery to move on so they don't get caught and start hiding here because of Garda vetting processes and because they've done this and done that. And you're, we need to say, right, lad, you've done your shit. You were in prison. You got your, lad, whatever happened. Now you're doing well. Let's move on to the next process. Let's push them. Let's give them jobs. Let's give them the help they require to move on. Let's not stun them where they are. You know, let's not keep them there because most people have been traumatized as young kids and they've gone through that and tough and then they get caught up in addiction and life is tough and people don't want to know them. Now they're in recovery and people still don't want to know them and they're saying,
what's the point? Might as well go use, might as well back using because,
you know, I can't get the job. Yeah. Nobody wants me around, you know. So we need to start looking at a little differently at that.
That's why part of it should be the decriminalisation piece, 100%. You know. Because, like, you know, you're working in drug and alcohol services, like, the people are very unwell people, very hurt people, and they're using the only thing they have available to them to co-op, which is a drug. What services or what good is it to put that person into prison? But does it make any sense?
Yeah, we're putting people who are in pain, who are, you know, who are traumatised into prison, further traumatising them. It's
exposing them to more criminality and drugs and stuff like that. What's the master's you're doing?
Master's in addiction recovery in Trinity College, Professor Johan Ivers, yeah. So I'm
Joe Barry involved there?
He was, yeah. Joe's retired now.
Cockman.
Yeah, lovely man, yeah. So I'm just finished. I have one more assignment to do, which I need to get my arse out and do it. literature review, and then, a dissertation, as I said, non-absence-based recovery is what I'm trying to focus on. So, I'm enjoying it. I'm trying to buy me a little house at the moment. Like, I'm 45, I've done everything backwards. I'm trying to get the little house and the quality of life. And, my son is doing well and things are really, really good. And I'm really happy. So my quality of life is amazing and I'm really happy and content. And I've probably never been in this place in my life. You know what I mean? I'm happier now than I ever was when I was 25, 35, 45. So
it's brilliant to hear.
Yeah, yeah. It's about, the having the good people around me and the people that want the best for me and me wanting the best for them and just living my... Don't give two fecks what anyone thinks anymore. I suppose I would have spent a lot of time worrying about what other people thought and that... that attitude of not giving a fuck anymore is, sorry for cursing.
Okay, cuss there.
stood me well. Yeah.
I think you're amazing anyway.
Me too.
That's what I think.
Me too.
Yeah, you're a very inspirational woman.
Thank you.
And it's an honour to speak to you across the table.
Thank you very much. Honestly. Great to be here.
You know, before we move on,
yeah,
I just want to ask you a little bit about Drogheda. How's Drogheda? A couple of rocky years above, are people recovering from that? There's been a huge collective trauma in the town at the moment.
Very few rocky years for Drogheda. I suppose Drogheda is no different than any other town in Ireland. You look at, I suppose, there's towns like Longford, Turles, there's towns in Ireland that, I suppose, Drogheda came to the forefront because of what happened with the young man who died. We're getting there, I suppose. There is the Gearan report money has been kind of coming towards Drogheda now, and there has been a huge, the departments and the government departments have, pledged a lot of money towards it, and there's implementation of that happening. Our service, the Red Door, has seen an increase in staff, but it's getting there.
It takes time, doesn't it?
It does. You look at Limerick and what happened. Like, we're no, Drogheda is no different to Limerick.
Very similar, actually.
Yeah, very similar situation. There's still, I suppose, a lot of the people involved in the feud are either in prison or have left the country. The guards would tell us that. So, you know, it's kind of died down at the moment, and there's been a huge, a lot of guards have brought into the town, and there's a lot more awareness. A lot of the community is very good in Drogheda, and people are very, you know, were at the time very shocked and very scared. There was, you know, I mean, the young or old people were pretty, you know, shook up about it. But as a community, there's recovery from that traumatic experience is happening. A lot more secure people are kind of getting back to and hopefully that's the end of it.
And we wish everybody in Drogheda all the best with all that. And you never know, maybe we'll do a live podcast
going to ask you to come down for recovery month and maybe do a podcast. We have a podcast room in the Red Door.
It's September, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we were in Ballymun last year, so we can come to Drogheda this year.
That's a date now. You promised me.
Talk off camera. I don't want to commit to meet anything.
Timmy's
but
like, go on.
We'll be strategic.
No, I know.
If we're strategic about it, we could go up and record a podcast with you for Recovery Month and then kind of get a few different guests while we're up that side of the world. So look, we'll talk about it off camera. But it was lovely speaking with you. Thanks for coming to Cork to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
And best of luck with your masters.
Thank you.
And I hope we get it published.
Oh, so do I. Anybody out there that wants to talk to me about non-absence-based recovery, my phone number will be on the podcast.
Yeah, and your links, your social medias and stuff. Slán.
Slán.
Bye.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.